Good morning, everybody. My name is Peggy Grantham. It's because the program of Al-Anon works, and I choose to work the 12 steps in my life on a daily basis, most days, that I've been restored to sanity one day at a time. And for that, I'm grateful. And that journey thus far has been about 10 years, 5 months, and so many days. I don't know, 15 days or so. I don't keep up with it by the day, but I'm glad to be here. You really don't know how glad I am to be here because I'm one of those people that's not very nice to myself a lot of times. I get caught up in the things of the world, and I push myself to the point of no return sometimes, and that's exactly what I've been doing recently, and I needed this weekend. I really did, and I appreciate you having us here, and it's so good to see a lot of our I won't say old friends, but friends we've known for a while that we've been privileged to meet before, and it's just really good to be here. So I'm supposed to share with you today a little bit of what it was like for me and what happened and what it's like today. I think the more important thing I have to do this morning is clean up detail. I feel that a few things were left out last night, I think. At any rate, I'll try not to take his inventory, except when necessary. And reveal a little bit of me. Because I know from previous experience that today there's somebody here that needs to hear about me. There's somebody here that has had the same experience, perhaps, or having the same experience. And, you know, it just always seems to be when I go to a speaker meeting that person most of the time has something I need to hear. And so I'm going to try to do that to the best of my ability this morning. I've asked God for his help, and more importantly, I've asked him to use me as his instrument. So I feel like that whatever I say today will be by God's design. I'm a country girl born and raised in Arkansas, southeast Arkansas, where they raise rice, soybeans, cotton, and mosquitoes as big as helicopters. And I promised God a long time ago that if he ever let me get out of there, I wouldn't go back. And so far, I've kept my part of that promise. I do. My mother and two sisters still live there, and I do go back and visit. But not more often than is absolutely necessary. And I usually try to do that in the wintertime when there are no mosquitoes, because those things are merciless. And I would have to tell you that I was probably raised in a normal home. When I first got here, I heard one of those buzzwords, you know, those catchy phrases that I adopted for a long time. And often referred to my family as dysfunctional. And some Al-Anon speaker had the audacity to straighten me out this year by telling me that the only thing that was dysfunctional about my family, or the only reason that it was dysfunctional, was because I was in it. And I think that's probably more accurately the truth. As I said, there were three girls, and my father was a farmer. He actually held down two jobs. He was a farmer, and he was also a postman, worked for the United States Postal Service. And he was a hard worker. And most of our social life revolved around a little missionary Baptist church out in the country. And we attended that church on a regular basis. In fact, every time the doors opened. And as a result of that, most of my friends were from that church. And one thing that they did back during that time that I don't see anymore, and at least I guess I'm not around it, but I've never heard of it in the last few years. But we used to have what we called singing schools, where we had this director that would come down from Little Rock and teach us how to sing by shaped notes. And at the close of one of those sessions, he picked out three people from the group that had been doing this all week and formed a trio. And those three people, unbeknownst to him at the time, were me and my two sisters. And we traveled and sang gospel music for many years, or for several years. Traveled Arkansas, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Missouri, I believe. But anyway, we went to places and sang gospel music. I don't know how it is in Monteagle, Tennessee, or where you live, but to me, gospel music means one thing, and that is you get down on it. I mean, it ain't this typical hymn kind of stuff that I hear so much of, but I mean, we got down. It was that foot stomping, hand clapping. You know, I had a tambourine, still have it. And I mean, I just beat that thing, I beat my hip blue. And I enjoyed that. I mean, that gave me something to sink my teeth into. And when I was on the stage performing, I felt exhilarated. I felt alive. But when I left that stage, something happened. That hole in my gut that I had developed at an early age returned. It constantly plagued me. And as years went on, the hole got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and finally became an all-consuming vacuum. Well, I had these friends in church. There were about, oh, I don't know, 5 or 6 or 7 of them, and 3 of them were girls about our same age. And I loved to go to their house and visit them. And, you know, the thing back then was you go... I think kids nowadays call it an overnight. We went to spend the night and, you know, you just lay in bed and be 3 or 4 of you in a bed, you know, and you'd lay there and you'd talk all night and you'd talk about the boys and you'd, you know, just, it was just fun girl things, you know. But I had a great time with them. And the reason I liked to go visit them was because their daddy, Mr. John, was a big, robust, hugging teddy bear kind of guy. And I love that man. And it was always fun for me to go there because when I would go there, he would pick me up, swirl me around, and make me feel like a princess. He made me feel like I was somebody. I was important. And he loved me, and I knew that. Well, the sad part of that was when I would go home, I expected the same thing from my father. I thought that's what daddies were supposed to act like. And I spent many a year going home expecting my father to treat me just exactly like Mr. John did. But my father wasn't like that. He was not a bad person. He wasn't a mean person. But he just wasn't an affectionate person. But I couldn't understand that. And I certainly could not accept it. And so I would try everything I knew to get him to do that, to respond to me like that. I made good grades. I kept my nose clean and tried to stay out of trouble and do everything right. And I became an overachiever just to get my daddy's attention. I remember one time when I was very young, he was sitting in his recliner chair and I was on the floor, and I thought, gee, how neat it would be just to get up and sit in his lap, and maybe if I do that, he'll hug me. Well, I got up and started to get in his lap, and he pushed me away. And that's the first time that I remember feeling what I grew to be a constant companion of mine for many years, and that was rejection. Felt it many, many more times after that. But that was the first time I consciously felt rejected. When I was about 17 years old, I discovered love. In the back of a 57 Ford. And since I'm to be honest with you today, I will have to tell you that I know today that wasn't love, that was lust. And if you're raised like I was raised, there's only one way you can cover that kind of sin, and that's to get married, and that's exactly what I did. I married that man, and we, about a year later, had a child. And it didn't take me an awful long time to figure out that something's wrong with this picture. I had missed out, you see, on all of those things, I guess, or I felt I had missed out on a lot of my growing up years, and the grass has got to be greener on the other side, and I don't want to live like this the rest of my life, and constantly this hole's getting bigger, you know. So I decided that I needed to get rid of this husband and get on with my life. But you can't get on with your life with a husband hanging around your neck and a kid that's 6 years old. And so I had to get rid of him. I mean, somehow or way I had to get rid of him because, you just don't go out and run around on a man you're married to. You know, that just wasn't kosher. I still had a few principles left at that time. And so I first had to make arrangements for my daughter. And this is a part of my story that probably grieves me worse than anything else that ever happened in my life. But it's true, and I have to tell it like it is. But I knew that I had to get rid of this child, and I have a sister that probably could qualify for this program. And I knew that. Angie was 6 years old. I took her to school. We lived in Little Rock at the time. And this was back during the time now when we were right on the heels of the forced integration. And you remember the scenario that played itself out in Little Rock. And it was an ugly scene. Well, those people over there still, even though it had been forced on them, they still were not happy about it. They were a little, just get a little teeny bit upset about it. Well, I went to take Angie to school, and she had a black teacher. Now, I'm very sure that this teacher was probably a wonderful teacher. And I feel sure that she would have done a marvelous job, but I never gave her the opportunity. And I never gave her the chance because I saw that as my opportunity to do what I needed to do. And I manipulated my sister by calling her and telling her that this was the situation. And she said, knowing that she had strong feelings about it, she said, "You bring her on down here and I'll put her in school down here." And I did that. And she lived with my sister for the next 8 years. Well, I've got rid of the kid, and I've got to get rid of this husband. And the way I chose to go about that was I provoked him a little. He slapped me around a bit, and I had perfect justification for a divorce. And I got it. And I went on about the process of living my life as I thought it ought to be. And I was trying all this time to fill this big hole in my gut. And I'm here to tell you today, without taking a fifth step, that I tried everything known to woman to fill that hole in my gut, including clothes, cars, men, jobs, you name it, I tried it, with the exception of drugs, which, as far as I know, weren't even a part of the world back then. If they were, I didn't know it. I did try alcohol, never liked what the stuff did to me, though. My daddy didn't drink. There was not any drinking in our home. I'd never been around it. But, of course I got exposed to it, running around with some of these worldly men that I was running around with. But I never liked what that stuff did to me, because you see, when I drink, my tongue gets loose at both ends. I cease to become a lady, and I just don't like to be out of control. I just don't like it. It just, I want to be in control at all times of my faculties. And so I did it because I was in a situation maybe that I thought I had to, but I didn't do it because I liked to and didn't do that much of it. Well, I took a few geographical cures even, to Dallas, Texas and back to Little Rock and then finally to Forest City, Arkansas, ended up there in 1975 with no job and nowhere to go. And I had a choice. I could go back to my hometown, which I'd already told God I didn't want to do, wasn't going to do. Since I had a divorce, nobody in my family had ever been divorced. My daddy just didn't think that was nice at all. He just did not approve of that, and I knew it, and I wasn't going back down there for him to criticize me and, about everything I did. I could go back to Little Rock, but I've probably had more enemies there than I had friends, so I just didn't think that was the proper thing to do. I'd never been to Memphis, Tennessee but one time in my life, and that was to see a pro football game. It was an exhibition game between the Jets and the Patriots, I believe. And I didn't go there to see my future husband either. I went to see Joe Namath. I always have to do that for his ego, just in case. But at any rate, I had never been there, as I said, didn't know anybody there, but being somewhat of a gambler and not afraid of anything, I decided that I would go to Memphis. And the first apartment I had barely enough money to pay the rent, turn on the utilities, and the apartment manager was a little bitty short lady, and her name was Shorty. She probably was that high. Having nothing to do every day, of course I didn't have a job, and no prospects of one, I'd go down and sit and talk to Shorty every day, because you see, I was attracted to Shorty. There was something about her that I liked. She had a glow on her face, she was smiling constantly, and she told me about the God of her understanding. She also told me about the sordid places she'd been in her life, and how she'd come out of there with the help of the God of her understanding. And I was fairly impressed with this. And there was something that drew me like a magnet back to her every day. I'd make a pot of coffee, go down and sit and talk to Shorty for most of the day. Finally, one day in September of 75, I went back to my apartment and I was as miserable as I have ever been in my entire life. Because you see, that hole had already gotten so big that it was about to take me in with it. And I knew that I was going to have to do one of two things. I was either going to have to find something to fill that hole or blow my brains out. But I could not live like that anymore. And so I went back to my apartment that day. It being a townhouse, I went upstairs, went in the bathroom, shut the door, put the lid down, crossed my arms, and for the first time prayed a sincere prayer to a God that I did not know, nor did I understand. Because you see, up until that time, I had grown up with a God that I feared. That God I knew in the Baptist church was one of them getcha gods. You didn't do what you're supposed to do, like your mama said do and like your daddy said do, God gonna get you. I was scared totally to death of this God. But Shorty's God didn't seem to be like that. And so I prayed to a God that I didn't understand or didn't know. And I said these words: God, I don't know what that lady's got that I ain't got, but whatever it is, I want some of it. And with that, it was like a bolt of lightning hit me in the top of my head and went all the way through my body. And I knew when I got to Al-Anon and read all of that material that I ordered for Larry so he could be sure and stay sober, I knew when I read that story about Bill Wilson in that hospital in New York, I knew exactly what he was talking about, because I experienced that in 1975. And you know, that hole was gone. And I felt love. I knew what love was. It wasn't anything like I'd experienced before that time. But I knew what love was. And I wanted to share it with the whole world. But there wasn't anybody around but Shorty, so I went back and shared what had happened with Shorty. She seemed to be excited about that. And she invited me to go to her church with some more single friends. And so I did. And you know, I kind of liked that church. It was kind of different than anything I'd ever been to. It was a Pentecostal church. But there were two things that I absolutely loved about that church and still like about it today. And that was their music. I mean, those folks know how to sing, now I'm telling you. They know how to get happy. And I like that. And I like their God. Because you see, their God was a God, was one of these gimme gods. Whatever you needed, you prayed and you asked God and He'd give it to you. And I like that. I really like that. I went for many years and finally decided that I would like to become a part of this. I knew it would break my mother's heart and my daddy's too, but I really wasn't into caring about that at the time. And so I, one of the girls that was in this group of people that we ran, that I ran around with, was about my age, and I really consider Patsy to be my first spiritual sponsor. And so I told Patsy that I would like to join this church, and she said, well, you'll have to talk to Pastor so-and-so. And so I said, okay. So she set it up, and I went to talk to Pastor so-and-so and told him what I wanted. And he took one look at me and said, well, you know, if you become a member of this church, that you can't wear any jewelry. You can't wear anything but a wedding ring and a watch. And I said, well, I'm not married. He says, then you can wear a watch. Well, I'm sure you can look at me today and know that that wasn't nothing that I wanted to hear. So I said, I'm out of here. But I felt rejected. I didn't feel good enough. I felt lesser than. That was also one of the things that had plagued me ever since I was in high school. I never felt good enough. And that just sort of cinched it. The church wouldn't accept me because I wasn't good enough. And I went on. Never did become a member of that congregation. Somewhere down the line, Patsy and one of these fellas paired off and decided to get married. And so that kind of left, you know, a couple of us dangling. And the other one decided to get married. And all of a sudden, I could see this picture. I was going to be here all by myself. So I said to Patsy, you know, I think I want to get married. I'd like to get married. She looked at me and she said, well, I'll tell you what, God's going to have to clean you up first. And I didn't think that was very nice. But figuring that she was closer to God than I was and she knew more about it than I did, I figured I better listen. So I went on. Several months or years later, I brought up the subject again. She says, well, Peggy, I tell you what you do. You ask God, you pray and ask God to give you a husband. She said, but when you do, you be specific about what you want in a husband. Well, I didn't have a good relationship with my father. I didn't have a brother. I already told you about that first husband. Now, what did I know about what I wanted in a husband? Zilch. Nothing. But I certainly wasn't going to let Miss Patsy know that. Now, I'm here to tell you. Because she might have wanted to do the picking herself, and I didn't think I wanted that to happen. So finally one day, I go back up to my special place in the bathroom, and I said, okay, God, let me tell you what I think you ought to do. I didn't know much about asking then. Kind of told God, you know, how I thought things ought to be. Well, I told him, I said, I tell you what you do. You give me the husband that you think would be right for me. And God, did I live to regret that? Oh, yes, I did. And I had a job at the time that was kind of a parading ground for men, since I was a buyer and all these salesmen, you know, come through my office every day. And then, you know, it was just a perfect place to get a husband. And so every day I would go to work and these guys would come in and they were being reviewed for potential husband candidates. And, you know, there was days when it was like, ooh, wow. Other days it would be, oh, God, no, please. And, you know, some days, so-so. Until one day, this fellow walked in my office, and the girls will understand it, the guys, just bear with us. But he was tall, and he was handsome, had broad shoulders, little bitty skinny waist, and no butt at all. More importantly, he had this big, beautiful ring on his finger that, you know, I had no idea how many carats, but, you know, it sparkled and it got my attention. I thought, and then I found out he played football. And that was even more impressive because, you see, I'd always been a football fan. And so I did, you know, I was eat up with that. And I thought, oh, wow. I really got excited. And, you know, we talked for a while and seemed to have an awful lot in common, you know, and it just, I was fairly impressed with this fella. And so the next week, I decided that I best keep, you know, the interest going here, and I didn't want him to forget who I was or where I was, so I called his office in Mississippi on the pretense of having a business reason to call him. And they said, he's not here. I said, well, where is he? He's on the Gulf Coast. So what's he doing down there? He's on his honeymoon. And I'm here to tell you, I was devastated because I just knew that I knew that I knew that I knew deep down in my gut that this man was it. Nobody that I had met up until that time had impressed me as much as this fella had. Well, you know, life's got to go on. So we go back to the parade review, you know, the men parading through my office, and, you know, but nothing ever worked. And then on May 10th, 1983, this fella that had been there about a year before called me and asked me to meet him for a drink that afternoon. And I already told you I don't like to drink, but you know you got to do what you got to do. I believe the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous describes it as you must be willing to go to any length, and I was. And so I met him that afternoon for a drink, got drunk, took him home with me, and he ain't left yet. And if you weren't here last night, I want you to meet Mr. Wonderful, Larry G. And it got worse from there, let me tell you. You know, I certainly didn't mind him getting drunk that night because I did, and I, you know, like I said, you got to do what you got to do. But I mean, it just kept on and on and on and on, and this fella just seemed like he had a hollow leg. God, he could drink more beer and other stuff than any. I just never seen anybody drink like that. Not even all those goofy guys I'd been with in my when I lived in Little Rock. Nobody I ever knew drank like that. Nobody. And I felt it necessary after a while to discuss this with him. And so I tried having a talk with him about it, and he didn't seem to be too impressed with my talk, so I got a little more adamant about it and did a little lecturing, and that didn't seem to work either. And so things got a little more heated. And I yelled and screamed a bit, and that's probably putting it mildly. He got to wrecking cars, going to jail. And you know, this just didn't make any sense to me. As I said, I really don't think I would have minded him drinking. But it was all that other crap that went with it that, you know, I mean, I'm a hard-working girl. I know how to work hard. I was raised on a farm. I know how to work hard. But I'm going to tell you, I never had a job in my life and still don't that was as hard as trying to keep that alcoholic's life together on a daily basis. He could undo more in 15 minutes than I could put together in 15 days. I mean, it was unbelievable. And I couldn't understand why he couldn't understand this, you see. And I pointed it out to him several times. Well, things got so bad that he almost lost his car, and being the good, not even a wife at that time. I think we call them significant others. Well, being the good, significant, caretaking other that I was, I go down to the bank, have the car put in my name, and get the insurance on it because he doesn't have a driver's license. I said, aha, I've got him now. So I go home and I say, okay, here's the deal. I told him what I'd done. And I said, now, that means you cannot drink and drive. Do you understand that? Oh, yes, he understood that. Well, guess what? His memory is really bad. He forgot. Well, I brought it to his attention, and he forgot again. Well, finally, I was just getting fed up to here, you know? I mean, I just had it. So our usual routine was that I would get up, go to work, and then he would get up and go do whatever he did. And I would sit there all day long and worry and fret and can't wait till 5 o'clock because I got to rush home, and I live all of 2 miles from the office, and I rush home, and I sit there in my chair, and I fume, and I pray, God, please let him get home safely, and don't let him kill anybody, and don't let him kill himself. And the minute he comes in that door, I'm as mad as I have ever been in my life. I mean, you know, it's unbelievable how it could change that quick. But he always stopped at Burger King and got himself a Burger King sandwich on the way home. And if he wasn't there by 7 o'clock, I knew, big trouble. Big trouble if he wasn't there by 7. But he would come in the back door, and this one day, one night he came in, and I'd been to the beauty shop that day and got my hair cut, and it's pretty short. And he came in and stood there by my chair and looked at me and said, "Well, if I'd been going to marry a goddamn man, I'd have married one." Takes his little Burger King sack, goes, sits down on the couch, and turns around and looks at me and says, "And besides that, your clothes are ugly." He hadn't ought to say that. Because the next day I go down to Goldsmith, charge myself $500 worth of new clothes, and it took me 3 years to pay for them, but by God, I got even. Insanity. Just insanity. Well, he's kept on and on, and so I finally decided the only way I could remedy this problem was to take his car away from him. And so one of these nights after he came in and lay down on the couch and passed out, I got the keys and called my friend and had her follow me way across town, way over there somewhere by where Milton and Joanne live. And I couldn't find it again if my life depended on it. But we went over there and I hid his car and came back home. So the next morning he gets up and says, "Where's my car?" I said, "It's gone." "Well, what'd you do with it?" "Well, I'm not going to tell you." So I let him worry me a while, you know, and finally I said, "Okay, I'll tell you what. I'll take you to get the car if you promise me that you won't drink and drive." "Oh, I promise." Well, guess what? He lied too. And there is no telling how many times I did that. And we'd go through the same sick routine every time. Just sick. Just insanity. Finally, in May of 1986, he told you the story. But I had also gone home that weekend to tell my parents that I can't live like this anymore. Because, you see, the doctor had told me I had developed some serious, serious health problems as a result of stress. And the doctor had said, if you don't get a handle on this stress, you're going to be dead in less than a year. And I was coming up on that year. I was within 4 months of the year that she had told me I'd be dead, and I wasn't ready to go yet. So I went home and I told my family, for the first time I'd been honest with them. I'd never been honest with them about what was going on in my life. They didn't even know Larry drank. But I was honest that day and I told them what was going on and that I was leaving and going to California. And I knew if I let him know what I was going to do, being the master manipulator that he was, and he could always talk me out of or into anything, it didn't matter, and probably still could. But he has a silver tongue in his mouth, and I knew if I let him know what I was going to do, it was over. That he'd talk me out of it, and I'd be right back in that mess again, and I knew I had to get out. So they were supportive in that they said, "Well, you do what you got to do, you know, and we won't let him know anything if he calls us." So I go back to Memphis, and in a driving rainstorm, and get there, his car's not home. That's not a bit unusual, but when I started to open the back door, he opened it for me. And I said, well, where's your car? And he says, we have to talk about that. And you know that old sick, you know, feeling you get in the pit of your gut and you know, I mean, you know what happened so many times. So he did tell me what had happened, and he told me he thought he needed some help. Now, up to that time in my life, I had always been there for Larry. Always. In fact, I was there before he even thought he needed me most of the time. I always rescued him. I always picked up the hot checks. I always saw to it there was bail money to get him out of jail. And I never went and got him myself. But I always saw that there was someone there with the money to go get him. I took care of the bills, tried to keep the bills paid. And this time, God did for me what I had never been able to do for myself, and I said no. I said, Larry, the phone book is full of people that can help you, but I cannot. And I went to bed, and for the first time in a long time, had a very peaceful night's sleep. Went to work the next day, and he did call me back home, and these treatment center people were there, and they talked him into going back with them, and I thought, all right. But before they left, they did one stupid thing. They asked me to come over there the next day. Now, I don't know that they told me this, but I assumed that it was to make the financial arrangements, and I thought, well, that's, you know, I could do that. At least he'll be out of my life. That'll give me, you know, 2 weeks to get the hell out of Dodge. Well, I slept real good that night for the first time. You know, I always slept good when I knew where Larry was. If he was in jail, I slept good. He was in that treatment center that night. I slept good. It was, you know, it was just like it was a peaceful sleep. But sometime between the time he left that afternoon and the time I got to that treatment center the next day, I am here to tell you 30-some years of wrath and anger and hostility boiled up in me. And when I got there, I was mad. Because, you see, I thought, this is just one more of his scams. He is going to go over there and convince those people that nothing's wrong. And I am going to let them know different. He ain't going to get by with it this time. Because it seemed to me they knew a little bit about what they were dealing with. And I was going to make sure they understood exactly what they were dealing with. So when I walked in over there, I said, I want to see the administrator of this hospital. And they took me to this man who portrayed himself as the administrator. Could have been a janitor, I don't know, and it really didn't matter. But if there ever was a flying, bouncing bitch from hell, I'll assure you, she showed up in Brinkley, Arkansas that day. And I went through that hospital, and one by one, I let every last one of them know exactly what they had on their hands. That he lied. And all of the other things that I felt were necessary for them to know in order to successfully treat him. I ended up that night with the same counselor he talked about last night, Larry G. And, you know, Larry listened to all of my tips. Now, this took all day long, I'm here to tell you. I mean, all day. From 9 to 6. And about 6 that night, I was sitting with Larry G, and I was telling him. And he listened. And he told me two things that day that saved my life. Number one was, he said this to me, Peggy, if you went home from work and Larry was sitting in his recliner chair with a gun in his lap and he said to you, Peggy, I want to kill myself, but I don't have any bullets for this gun. I need you to run down to the store and get me some bullets. The counselor said to me, would you do that? I said, well, that's absurd. No, I would not. He said, in essence, my dear, that's what you've been doing all this time. Every hot check you've ever picked up, every time you've ever bailed him out of jail, every time you've ever rescued him, every time you've ever done for Larry what Larry should have been doing for himself, you've loaded another bullet in the gun. And for the first time, I realized the part I played in this whole sick situation. It made the hair stand up on the back of my neck. To think that I could have been, I considered myself a fairly smart person. And to think that I could have said, I love you, Larry, and at the same time, be loading the bullets in the gun to kill him. That's pretty sick. Pretty sick. Larry G. also asked me that, told me that day, he said, you need to go to Al-Anon. And I didn't know what that was, and I said, well, what's that? And I feel very sure that Larry G. told me to the best of his ability that day what Al-Anon was. But I'll tell you what I heard. Now, when Larry gets out of here, he's going to be going to some meetings. And you need to go with him to make sure that he goes to the meetings and don't go get drunk. Does that sound familiar to anybody? So that's exactly what I did. And on June 9th, 1986, I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting in Memphis, Tennessee at the Turning Point Group. And there's some of them old biddies there. Later, we went on over to another group in Whitehaven. And there's some of them old biddies there. And they told me things I probably needed to hear, but I was too very interested at that point and still too focused on him and what he was doing and the fact that he might get drunk. That, you know, I would sit there and listen to the best of my ability, but knowing all the time I had to, as soon as you said amen, I got the boat for the door and go down the hall and make sure he's still there. I just knew I was going to catch him. But you know, I never did. And it took me a long, long time to ever become comfortable and to, for the fear to ever go away. And one of them old biddies had the audacity to tell me one time I needed to join the MYOB club. And, you know, I'm a perfectionist. You probably figured that out by now. And, you know, whatever I do, I always want to do it right. I always want to do it right. And, you know, I was trying to get this thing right, trying to get all my, you know, I's dotted and T's crossed and do like I was supposed to do, like I thought you expected me to do. And here I've screwed up royally. I haven't done something. It embarrassed me because I didn't know what she was talking about, but I was just too proud to ask. Finally, I figured it out. And then somebody else pointed it out again to me that I needed to leave Larry's recovery to you in AA, and that I needed to focus on Peggy and what was going on with Peggy. And so I began trying to do that, and one of the ways I did it was through sponsorship. Because you see, I heard you tell me that I needed to get a sponsor, and I said, well, how do I do that? I asked a lady at Shoney's one night, and she said, well, you qualify them first and ask them if they've done a fourth and fifth step, and if they hadn't, you move on. Well, I went back to my, at that time, home group and asked the three ladies there that seemed to be the gurus. And I asked them if they'd done a fourth and fifth step, and they said no, they didn't feel it necessary to do so, so I moved on. And one night, this lady walked in, little bitty short lady about that tall. God has a way of using those little bitty short ladies in my life, it seems. But Doris walked into a meeting that night, and I asked her, and she said, yes, I have. And I said, will you be my sponsor? She said, yes. And so that began a journey that was to change my life. She, along with a lot of other people in the Memphis area, helped me through my steps and helped me to get the focus off of Larry and on to Peggy. And it's been a beautiful journey. And in the process of doing that, I have to tell you about an amend that I had to make that was probably the most painful amend I've ever made. You see, I told you about this daddy that I didn't like. Didn't think he treated me right all of my life. And on November the 1st of 1993, my husband came to my office, white as a sheet, and walked in where I was eating lunch and said, Peggy, your daddy just dropped dead with a heart attack. I said, no, not my daddy. He said, yes. You see, my daddy hadn't been sick. I'd only been with him 2 weeks before. Went down to show him my new car. Took him riding. He and I rode for several hours together. And he told me that I'd spent too much money for a car. Still vendetti. But we had a wonderful day. We talked a lot. Talked about a lot of things. Had a wonderful day. It's probably the most time that I ever spent with my dad. Just he and I. And on this day, when Larry came to my office, of course I went home, and I knew there was one more amend I had to make to my daddy. You see, my sponsor had told me some years before that to make proper amends to my father, that I would have to go back and treat him like I wanted him to treat me. That was not an easy task for me. Because you see, it meant I had to go and hug a man that had never hugged me. And it was hard. I remembered from years ago when he pushed me away. I didn't want that to happen again. But my sponsor said you must do that. And so I had done that for several years. And it was like it became easier each time I would do it. And it got to the point where the last day that I ever saw my father alive, instead of me reaching out to hug him, he reached out to hug me. But I knew I had one more amend to make to him. And so I went there, and as he lay in state at the funeral home, I went in, closed the doors, and told him, "Daddy, I am so sorry that I was not able to accept the love that you gave me all of my life. You see, I was so busy looking for what things the way I wanted them to be that I couldn't see all the love that he gave me all of those years. You see, my father was the child of an alcoholic. I didn't know that until after I got in Al-Anon and his sister told me of the life they had lived. He was a very abusive alcoholic. He beat my father. And you know, the one thing that my father wanted to give me that he never had was security. He never had that in his home. He slept many a night in a cotton field. He and his brothers and sisters and my grandmother. He didn't have the security of a loving home. My daddy worked two jobs just so my mother wouldn't have to work and could stay home with us girls. I didn't see all of that. I was so selfish and self-centered that all I could see is what he didn't do for me, like I wanted it done. And so that day, I did, to the best of my ability, an amend to him to say, "Thank you, Daddy, for what you did. And please forgive me for not being able to see it. And today I'm okay with it. And today I know that somewhere, wherever he is, that he's looking down and he's saying to me, 'That's my girl. And I'm proud of you. And I'm okay.' I had a wonderful father, and I want you to know that. A wonderful father." This program has given me so many miracles in my life that I couldn't, if I stayed here the rest of the day, I wouldn't be able to tell you about all the wonderful things that have happened. But one of the things that it has given me is I no longer have the need to play God in somebody else's life. And I want to tell you about an incident that happened that shows me I have truly grown in that area. In July of 1993, was a bad year for me, but we had gone to in Evansville, Indiana, to do one of these kind of things, and when we got home, we found out that my grandson had been kidnapped. And it was an unusual kidnapping in that we knew who had him, we just didn't know where he was, and they refused to give him up. My grandson has special needs. He is, I don't know, if he may be slightly retarded, but he nonetheless he is emotionally disturbed. We do know that. And so he was in a special schooling situation that someone took advantage of over in the state of Arkansas, and it ended up, my daughter couldn't, and son-in-law couldn't get him back, and required the services of a lawyer that was very expensive, and they didn't have the money, and they came to me and asked me for the money, and this time I had always, you know, sort of done the same for my daughter that I did, you know, for Larry, kind of always, you know, was right there and provided whatever the need was most of the time before it was asked for. And so I had enabled her in a lot of ways, but this time I felt differently about it in that I didn't see it as enabling. I saw it as reaching out and caring for a little boy that needed it. And so I got the money, and we took it to this lawyer, and he did not give us a prayer of getting him back. We knew that they had a court hearing scheduled on Friday. He had found that out. And this was the second of three adoption hearings that was based on some false affidavits. And so he said, we don't have a prayer of getting him back, but he said, all I want to do is to get into court and let this judge know that he does, in fact, have a family that loves and cares for him. But, you know, I don't, he said, we'll try to have to get another hearing scheduled. Well, I knew something just told me if we didn't get him back that day, they would take this child and leave and we'd never see him again, you know. So when you've done all you can do, or at least this is the way it seems to work for me, when I've done all I can do, then I do what I should have done to start with, and that is turn it over. So I went back to the bathroom, and again, I asked God this time, I said, you know, I don't know what's best for Joshua. And I'm willing at this point to let you be the judge of that. Now, maybe it's in his best interest that he stay with these people he's with. But if not, God, I love him. I don't want to give him up. And I want him back. But I'm willing to leave it in your hands. And we went into court that day. And when little Joshua got to court with those people and came off the elevator, I was the first person he saw. And he came running to me and he said, Grandma, I didn't think I'd ever see you again. And he held me and just held on to me. And the judge did something that day that I understand judges don't do. She overturned her own ruling of Monday and gave little Joshua back to us, and we left that courthouse with him that day, and he's still with us. Now that, to me, is God's love. And I could just go on and on, but I know I don't have time. But I do thank you for being there for me 10 years ago. I thank you for all of the things you told me that I didn't want to hear and didn't appreciate at the time. And I'm sure there's going to be some more of those times, and that's okay. But I appreciate you being here for me. And you know, I hope after talking with Arlene and Marge, I believe, last night, I do hope that we can keep this Al-Anon program as pure, and as simple as it was 10 years ago when I got here. And that I'll be there, and I'll be here for another Peggy that walks through those doors in the future. Before I leave you, I want to tell you one thing. When you take a man's money, all you take is his money. But when you take a man's time, you take part of his life. Thank you for part of your life. God bless you, and I love you.